We present Best Sellers. Best Sellers, featuring great works by famous authors of today and yesterday. In June 1942, two German U-boats headed quietly into American waters, aimed at two isolated beaches. On board each craft was a team of four men, eight specialists, primed for an audacious mission, codenamed Operation Pistorius. But neither team knew of another passenger with an even greater mission that could shake the world. He was the Ninth Man. The Ninth Man. A chilling story based on historical fact by John Lee and dramatized for radio in 25 episodes by Victor Magson.
Kid. Oh, I didn't mean to wake you. Thought you were asleep.
Don't kiss me, Mommy. You smell all nasty.
Well, that's booze, baby. Mommy's been to a party.
Grandma says ladies don't drink.
Well, they do sometimes, if they like to have a good time. Now, you go back to sleep, baby. It's way past your bedtime.
Did you have a good time, Mommy?
Mommy had a lovely time. She ate lovely dill shrimp and nasty caviar, and she drank lovely rum punch, and she met two lovely young men who are going to get lovely big medals pinned on them tomorrow by the president before he goes to lovely Hyde Park. Now, you go back to sleep.
Didn't Andy go to the party?
Sure, Andy went. And he bought Mommy a lovely big steak after we left. And she wouldn't eat it because she was all filled on lovely shrimp. And now she's starting all over again. And now she's going to make a lovely big bologna sandwich. My baby.
Night, Mommy.
As I listened to the voices of Gay and Gaylin down the hall, I looked into the big mirror in Gay's bedroom and decided that I had had far too much to drink. Maybe Gay had had even more, and consequently woke Gaylin when she looked in on her daughter. Well, I gazed at my image in the mirror and so reflected the good conduct medal pinned on my perfectly pressed khaki jacket. It made, I felt, a pretty poor showing against all the medals that had been prominently displayed at the cocktail party that night.
Hey, lover, why so pensive? And still fully dressed on top of it? You might at least have removed your tie. Or at the very least notice me creeping in with a large, delicious... A couple of large, delicious bologna sandwiches in my tiny hand.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought, Gaylin...
No, she dropped off long ago.
Gay, tell me, it's been on my mind quite a lot lately. Daughter whose father was an Annapolis professor, girl who was raised among a sea of uniforms. What exactly does a Navy Cross look like?
Bronze, I guess. You don't see all that many of them.
Hmm.
What's the matter, baby? Are you jealous? I didn't do a thing at the party tonight. Now, you know that. Just chatted with those two boys a little bit. Why? I'm old enough to be their mommy.
I am not jealous.
The hell you weren't. And if you're not, you'd better be. Ah, weren't they gorgeous? I can't wait until I'm old enough to take up really young men. College boys. Senate pages. Ooh, I wonder why they're always cuter than house pages. Now, after Congress, we're going to run you for the Senate, baby, and that'll give me easy access.
Oh, yeah, well, that definitely settles it. No politics for me. May I remove my jacket, Mom?
Sure, lover. Now, what is bothering you tonight? Seriously, now?
Me? Nothing. Nothing at all.
You are jealous, aren't you?
Of course not, Gay. Hell.
No, I don't mean of me.
Why the hell shouldn't I be?
I mean those two fuzz-faced kids in the brilliant white uniforms and all their ribbons and the way people hang all over them this evening. That's it, isn't it? The old social pressure business. You hate being in Washington when there's so much going on in the rest of the world, right?
Oh, come on, it's silly.
Is it? Well, I'll tell you something, baby. You've got the opportunity of a lifetime down there in the White House, but you don't take the least advantage of it. Don't you realize how much a few words in the right ears could mean to your political career?
I don't have a political career.
No, and you're not likely to if you don't stop wasting time. You ought to see people, talk to them, jog a few elbows. And frankly, lover, you could take a hint from those two flyers. It wouldn't hurt you a bit to go overseas and win a medal or two for yourself. That's the best way in the world to win votes.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Gay, I'm not trying to win votes. I mean, this political nonsense is all your idea. And now you want me to chuck everything and go overseas. Hell, I wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for you.
I know, baby. You'd be fighting chiggers at Fort Still. Now, don't start all that frowny frowning. You know I want you here with me. And it would be pure hell if you went off on active duty. But I'm just trying to be practical. Take Ulysses S. Grant. Now, how in hell do you think he ever got to be president? By being good in business administration? No, he was a war hero, that's what. And it's going to happen again, just you wait and see. The successful politicos after this war are going to be the boys who've knocked off a few dozen Germans or Japs and come home with something to show for it.
Like a wooden leg or a mechanical arm.
Well, that wouldn't hurt. But I had more in mind a string of those lovely medals on their hairy chests. Like yours, Andy. Now that you've taken your tie off, I see what a lot of hair you have on your chest. Doesn't it get hot in the summertime? Come here, let me feel if it's real.
What? You'll call one of your little Navy heroes?
Oh, I'm getting sick of this.
Well, I'm already sick of it.
Are you? Oh, no. This is real hair. Maybe we'd better change the subject. Get off politics. Now, what can we do to get our minds off quarreling? I know. I have a good idea. I'll just toot downstairs and mix you a nightcap.
Yeah, maybe I should put my tie back on and join you.
Oh, I don't think the tie would be necessary. Come on down anyway. Maybe we'll even make it two or three nightcaps. What's the hurry anyway? We're not playing tennis tomorrow.
No, I guess not. Wednesday, June 17th, 1942. The war room in the White House. I guess I liked the heady feeling of being on the inside. A room where outsiders were practically never admitted, except on special occasions like this one, when war heroes were summoned to be decorated. The maps with their crayon drawings were nearly always days or weeks ahead of the newspaper headlines. It was like walking into a very large, very crucial crystal ball. And I let in the two young carrier pilots from the Enterprise and their naval public information officer that morning. Every man in the room rose to his feet in a gesture of respect. And the heroes were prodded forward into the maw of admiring military smiles and congratulatory friendship. They looked very pleased with themselves. Why not? They deserved it, didn't they? Or did they? Was my smile genuine? Was Gay right? Was I really jealous of them? Hell, we all had our jobs to do. We were assigned them, and we did them to the best of our ability. But looking at their keen, eager, fresh young faces, I let my mind wander over what they must have been through on the carrier Enterprise. We knew quite a bit about Doolittle's Tokyo raid, but what had happened at Midway just a matter of days before was another story, the real impact and significance of which would only be felt much, much later.
At 7 a.m. on June 4th, the first planes roared down the Enterprise's deck. Our Air Group 6 launched 57 planes, 10 Wildcats, 33 Dauntless dive bombers, and 14 Devastator torpedo planes to hit the enemy carriers off Midway. Before the day was done, the Enterprise, along with the Hornet and the Yorktown, had irreparably damaged the Japanese carriers Kaga, Akagi, Soryu, and Hiryu. At 3:41 that afternoon, 24 Dauntless from the Enterprise screamed down out of the air from 19,000 feet to deliver death blows to the Japanese craft. In a matter of hours, the enemy had lost four irreplaceable aircraft carriers, one heavy cruiser, 253 planes, and 2,300 men. Under Admirals Fletcher and Spruance, a decisive American victory had been won at Midway. It seems that 6 months after Pearl Harbor, naval balance in the Pacific has been restored. But victories are not gained without heroic deeds and tragic loss of life. The United States lost one carrier, the Yorktown, one destroyer, 147 planes, and 307 men. Admiral Nimitz has said that Pearl Harbor has now been partially avenged. Vengeance will not be complete until Japanese sea power has been reduced to impotence.
And it would seem that that objective is well on the way to being achieved. Maybe I should request active duty. Not for the benefit of a political career. That's Gay's fantasy, not mine. Hell, no one's enamored of the prospect of facing death and disfigurement, heaven forbid. But the world out there is real, and I'm not in it. In spite of my title and rank, what am I in here? I'm right near the seat of power, and when it comes down to brass tacks, I'm basically just a small person, an onlooker.
Captain, I'm speaking to you.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I was distracted. Did you wish something?
Yeah. We have a few minutes before the newsreel people and the photographers are expecting these young men to appear on the south lawn for interviews. So, we're going to sit a while and discuss the situation in the Pacific.
Yes, sir. Would you like me to join you, sir?
Not right away. We'll need coffee. Be a good fellow and run down to the kitchen for it, will you?
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
Must be a little crazy. 36 hours I've been playing cards. Foolish, perhaps, but worth it. I feel better now than I have since we arrived here. $200 playing cards. If I wasn't so darn tired, I could have won more. Ironic. For the first time in my life, I have all the money I need packed away in a leather briefcase. And then I start to win more. And now it's time to look in on Peter.
Ken? George! Where you been? You've been gone so long. Hank was furious at you for not showing up last night. Had the devil's own job trying to placate him.
At the blazes with Heinrich. I've made up my mind.
Yeah? What have you decided?
I am going to Washington. Tomorrow. I'll call down to the hotel desk, ask them to arrange a room reservation for me at the Mayflower for tomorrow night. Then after a good night's rest, I'll catch the train to Washington. I'll see the chief of the FBI and tell him that you and I are anti-Nazis and that we're giving ourselves up to save the country. We'll be heroes.
Are you sure?
Of course.
How can you be so confident? How do you know they'll believe you? Anything could happen.
Nothing will happen. I'm sure it's the only way. Calm yourself, Peter. They'll thank us. They'll reward us. We'll be celebrities. They'll want us to go on lecture tours and help sell war bonds. They'll give us parades in our honor. And the sooner we move, the better it'll be for us.
Well, may I come to Washington with you?
No. Someone has to keep Hank and Kieran from getting suspicious. Don't worry, Peter. I'll take good care of you. I'll tell them you helped me to plan it. I'll say we had this idea before we ever left Germany.
They'll call us traitors back home.
At least we'll be alive. You just keep Hank and Kieran happy for a few days until this is all over. Did you tell them what I suggested about looking for transport to move the explosives?
Yep.
Good. Well, add anything you like to keep them happy. Won't matter much longer.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll try.
Goodbye, Peter.
New man, Mr. Daniels. The quiet one. That's if his name is Daniels. I wonder. Called him that a couple of times since he moved in. He's been so slow to respond, like he doesn't know his own name. I wonder. Wouldn't be the first time I've rented a room to a phony, but he's a queer one. Hasn't even used the kitchen privileges I offered him. Heaven knows I've tried to make some of the unappetizing tenants I get feel at home, but this one just doesn't seem to fit in at all. Doesn't have any relatives in the hospital. No friends, as far as I can see. He's just too darn quiet. Went and bought himself a new car yesterday. Now, where does a man doing a little wildcatting, just drilling on a shoestring, get money for a car like that? Doesn't make sense. Just can't trust anybody these days. I think I ought to go up to his room sometime when he isn't around. Take a look-see. He might be a criminal for all I know. I'll bide my time. No telling what he may do if I just face him and start asking questions. Lots of criminals are plain crazy, mean and crazy. Next time he leaves the house, perhaps.
Mrs. Ellen Sue Fakinney's opportunity to search the room of her tenant came the next morning, the sixth day after the landing, Thursday, June 18th, the day that I was to hear for the first time about the spies having landed on our shores. Shortly after breakfast that morning, from the shadows of the dining room, she watched him come trotting down the stairs with a large tablet and a box of pencils and go out to his car.
Sitting there in his fancy Lincoln. Why would any Texan in Washington just for a couple of weeks rush out and buy a car? Dressed nice, too. Didn't have any nice clothes the day he first arrived. And now it's new gray slacks, nice navy blue sport shirt. Certainly knows how to make a bed. Neat. Too neat for a man living alone. Like someone who's been in the army or maybe in a penitentiary. Probably wanted circulars out on him right now. Could be something in the bedclothes. That's why he makes it up so neat. No, nothing under the sheets. Oh, nothing under the pillows. Mattress. Nothing under there either. Doesn't hide things where a lot of other tenants have. Now, where would he put anything he was frightened people might see? Mr. Beatty taped his government check behind the radio that time he said he was broke and couldn't pay the rent. Mrs. Masseur tried to hide her hot plate at the top of the old chiffon robe in her room. And those Polanski transvestites tried to hide their female clothing under a cushion in the easy chair. They thought they could hide things from me. But in this room, we don't have any of those things. No chiffon robe, no radio, just the chairs and the old carved dresser. Wonder what he has in there. Just as I thought. Clothes are all brand spanking new. Some of the price tags still on them. He could well be an ex-convict. Had to start from scratch. One thing I won't have in my house... Good Lord! What's this? Cards? Lots of them. Driver's license? Club memberships? Draft registrations? Social security cards. Frank Daniels. Raymond Patterson. A whole lot of other names. Is he letting other people use this room? Won't have none of that. He'll have to pay more rent. Shirts and things are all new like everything else. And dear God! A gun! Down here underneath. A big, heavy, ugly one. Now, what else? Belt of some kind. It's a money belt. Well, I'm darned. A fat one up there, full of money. Maybe he's been robbing banks, liquor stores, or something. Merciful heavens. Lots of money. Must be thousands of dollars here. But they're sort of wrinkled and warped. Like maybe he's tried to wash them off. Police. I better call the police. They ought to know about this. No. I've got a better idea. Much better. Just take the gun and the money belt.
At the President's Hyde Park estate that morning, I drank in the melange of wooded hills and fields and creeks and assorted family homes on the east bank of the Hudson River, and thought, what a long way it was from our old three-room shack in Colorado, and how Papa would burst with pride if he could have seen his little Andrage at that moment. I was curious, as awed by greatness as any man, wanting desperately to play my role of warrior in this instant of history, as the caravan of cars drove through the presidential family gate up towards the ranks of welcoming dignitaries. But I forced myself to let my eyes roam and note the skillful placement of Secret Service men lingering on the edges of the crowd of plenipotentiaries, the military guard of honor in chromed helmets and white gloves lining the wide driveway, the visiting British security agents who had arrived early, scanning the unfamiliar ground with nervous eyes. This was a great moment, fraught with tension, as we awaited the arrival of the British Prime Minister, who had come all this way to meet the Commander-in-Chief of the most powerful nation on Earth. Amazing, isn't it?
What is?
The President. It's the first time I've been quite this close to him.
Yeah. What about him?
Well, there he is in his wheelchair, a cripple with 10 pounds of steel encasing his withered legs. Yet he appears always robust, cheerful, with a smile as white as the Missouri, loved by millions.
takes a lot of guts to be like that in a vast country like ours.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Must be quite something to have the British Prime Minister come all the way over here to see him. Must be something big on the go.
Atop a small hill overlooking the empty train tracks running over the Maryland countryside, a man was sketching an old barn lying a mile or so across the way. Some knew him as Dietrich, others as Frank Daniels, some as Raymond Patterson, and many more by other names. But to me, he would become known as the Ninth Man. He had done quite a lot of sketching that morning, but one sketch was a much more detailed one, a carefully rendered drawing of the narrow little railway bridge below. A bridge over which, according to his information, a special train carrying two great world leaders would in a day or two be due to pass.
That was Episode 8 of The Ninth Man by John Lee. Adapted and directed for broadcasting in 25 parts by Victor Magazine. You have been listening to Best Sellers, featuring the masterworks of famous authors that have captured the imagination of the world.